Hi and welcome to episode 71 of Attention Place with Arnab Ray right here from Talking Stuff Network. Before we proceed, let me tell you about the latest episode of Binge On, a podcast that helps you decide what to watch. In the latest episode, Raj and I, we fall into the swirling logo of Doordarshan and fish out some recommendations from our childhood. So subscribe to Binge On your podcast player and never waste time deciding what to watch. And back to our show. We have a very, very special show today. We don't have VVS Lakshman, but we are very, very special nevertheless. So let me get our host, Arnab. Hey, Arnab.
Hello. Hello, everyone. So today we have a special show because we have a guest.
Yes.
We hear a lot of feedback that we need more guests. And I take that as not as a negative commentary on my podcasting skills, but surely a desire to have a conversation rather than me going buck on one side. So today we have, you know, somebody I've greatly admired for a long time, and I've been trying to get this person on the show for quite a few weeks. His name is Jairjun Singh. And we started off in the grand old days when there was no social media as such, and there was something called blogging, for those of you not old enough to remember. He was one of the first, I kind of cringe using the word blogger, but I'll use it in this case, first bloggers that I used to read, and I was really used to like his writing. And he writes for Indian media, and I love his writings on movies. We share some love for the 90s and the 80s and Dharmendra in Tights. So I've greatly admired his work. I've greatly admired his reviews on, you know, he writes serious literature reviews, unlike me. And that is going to be one of the questions that I'm going to ask him, which he doesn't know. But without much more introductions. Hello, Jay. Thank you for coming.
Hey, Arnab. Hi. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, we can hear you clearly.
Okay, Dano, thanks a lot for inviting me. And the admiration is mutual, as I think you know, even though we also disagree about many things. But there's so much nostalgia involved with having started out together, you know, 16 years ago this year. Can you believe that? And having so many common interests and so many things that we do, you know, feel passionate about in similar ways. So thanks a lot for inviting me here.
Okay, great. Thanks for coming. So before we get on to the main topic for today, there is something that is Jaipur Lit Fest season, and Jay is here. So it would be remiss of me not to talk about publishing, because Jay is an old hand, I would say, and please correct me if I'm wrong.
Arnab, in terms of, we have not told our listeners the full name. I mean, people, in case they're wondering who Jay is, it's Jairjun Singh.
Yes, I started with saying Jairjun Singh, by the way. That was the first thing I said. So now that it's Jaipur Lit Fest, another Jay, Jaipur Lit Fest time, Jay, tell us where Indian publishing is going. And you and I have sparred on this online, and you know I have very strong opinions on this. But I'll first start with you. Do you think Indian publishing has changed?
Changed since when?
A change since, let's say, 10 years. So 2010, which was, I think, when, around which time both of our books came out, right? Our first books.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
From 2010 to 2020, do you think, first of all, do you think it has changed? And if it has, for the better or the worse, and why?
Again, you know, I think it's, again, speaking as someone who's been on the beat for so long, it's a little difficult to make sweeping statements about whether it's for the better or for the worse. I think both things have happened sometimes simultaneously. Between, say, in the last 10 years, I don't have numbers at hand, but yeah, my feeling is that there's probably a lot more new publishing happening, at least in terms of Indian titles in English, than there were in 2010. back then, back in 2010, there were two, maybe three really major publishing houses that were doing a lot of fresh titles every year. And now there are 7, 8, 9, maybe. Lots of things have been tried in various fields, in fiction and non-fiction. As you know, I think there's something anyone who's part of the literary world would know, very often there's a certain amount of flailing around and not really being able to tell what will work in the market, what won't work. So publishers, because like anyone else, they are a business, they have to justify their existence, they will try out different things, try and publish the sorts of books that they feel have the best chance of finding a readership. And that can mean experimenting with many different genres, then maybe dumping one after a few years, trying out new things. There's definitely been a massive increase in popular fiction, mass market fiction in the last few years. 7, 8, 9 years ago, there were a couple of very less known publishing houses that were considered lowbrow, which used to publish a lot of books that some of the more literary sorts would look down on. But now you find even top publishers like Penguin and HarperCollins having separate imprints for the really massy stuff, the really fast-paced stuff. So there are changes like that. There have been changes in the field of film writing as well. There are probably more cinema books now than there were 10 years ago. It's a mix of good and bad, really, Arnab.
So for me, at least, and, you know, I don't know if you agree with this, but for me, I think things were better, definitely, in 2010, because I think that publishers had more money then, because there were some kind of legacy books, their legacy titles. Like, for instance, HarperCollins had their dictionaries, and that business is totally gone now. So there was this cash cow. There was these, you know, cash cow things that they could always rely on. Because I remember the first time that I ever met editor. The editor took me out to Cuba in Delhi, and you know, it was a fairly good paid for by the publisher dinner. And by the time I published my last book in Mahabharat Murders, I went to the publisher and I didn't even get a glass of water. So there was
that's something I could have mentioned as well. Those of us who are based in Delhi, which of course is perceived as the hub of the Indian literary world, we often joke about this that 8-10 years ago, it felt like every week or every couple of weeks one was being invited to a really fancy cocktail and canapé book launch at if not at a 5-star hotel, then definitely at a very upmarket restaurant or some such venue. And then at some point, publishers wisened up to the fact that even when you're calling 200 people to come and sip wine at such an event, you might end up with 8 or 10 books sold at that venue. And then, of course, as a result, quite understandably, they started tightening the belts, the budget belts. And in the last few years, it's not unheard of at all that if a mid-list author wants a book launch, then you know that person will probably tie up with the publisher, contribute some of his or her own money to hosting an event, and they'll split the costs. And this, of course, will be done in a much more modest way than book launches once used to be. So yeah, so that definitely is a change that has happened.
Yes, it's a good point that you bring up, that when we started out in 2010, it was expected that the author will take us, and that percentage hasn't changed. The royalty percentage hasn't changed much, if at all. But the rest of everything will be done by the publisher financially. But now I think increasingly we're moving towards a model where the publisher is essentially just printing your book. Yeah. And the author is responsible for everything from, you know, buying his own PR. In some of the authors that we know, some of the major authors have multiple PR agencies working for them. So it's a big cost that the author basically takes upon himself or herself. Again, I would say the popular authors, and so this would follow my second question would be, I remember once you had written an article which I, you know, which was about authors who don't read books. Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course, of course.
Many years ago. Yes. Yeah. So for those of you who haven't read the article, so Jay wrote an article. I don't know which newspaper it was. That I don't remember.
Is this the one that I mentioned the mine in your book?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. I think that was Business Standard. But I've also written about those things in a couple of other publications because, for instance, you mentioned the Jaipur Lit Fest. I've only actually been there once in the last 7 years. I haven't been going there much. But the last time I was there, I moderated a session which had some mass market writers on it, popular writers, and let me just clarify that when I say mass market writers or popular writers, I do not use these terms judgmentally at all. I have a lot of interest in all genres and forms of writing, and I think everything depends on the execution within those forms. But this session that I moderated, there was one author there who made a point of saying, almost with a great deal of pride, that he had never read a novel in his life until he wrote his own first novel. And of course, the audience was applauding away. And there's this sense of hubris almost that main writer hu, main reader nahi hu, main writer hu. And for those of us, this includes you and me and many others who take writing and reading seriously, for most of us, being a writer is inseparable from also being a good reader. That's where it comes from. But there are many young writers in India right now who are not readers themselves and take active pride in it. And of course, the flip side of that is that when you haven't read a lot of good stuff or any good stuff, you don't know what the existing standards are. You have no idea about what you're doing, how it compares with things that have already been done before, and then that can lead to a great deal of overconfidence, where you feel like anything you write is like it must be one of the first times that something like this has ever been done. There's a lot of delusion there.
Right. That's I agree. And once at one of the lit fests very few that I attended, I think one of the audience members said something which I felt was very insightful, in the sense that what she said was, she was, I think, a school kid or might be early college, but she said, I only pick up books that tell me my stories. So this was, it's, you think about it, it's actually fairly profound. So at least the way I look at literary, and I'm going to ask you this question right now, is the way I look at the distinction between literary and popular is that, in general, literary takes you to worlds that are not familiar to you.
Yeah.
And that is where the success or a failure of literary novels are, that they are not supposed to tell you your story. They're supposed to tell you somebody else's story. And popular is more that it's supposed to tell you your story. So how would you, and the reason why I say this is, I read an article that you wrote, I think this was a few weeks ago, about the best books that came out in the last 10 years in Indian fiction, right? So, I'll be a little facetious, why wasn't my book there? But no, seriously, the thing is, what distinguishes a great book that gets into your best book for 10 years in, books in general?
Okay, I don't actually remember writing any such piece. I did contribute to.
You contributed to.
I think that there was a piece that an online publication had done, Best of the Decade, where they invited many different people in the literary circuit to just nominate a few authors who they thought had done important things in the previous decade, and I sort of contributed to that. Again, Arnab, I have to sort of say this. You're slightly putting me on the spot, partly because I wasn't really prepared to do so much talking about publishing just now. I thought we were going to be talking about different sorts of villains rather than the obvious villains of the publishing and the writing world. But I largely agree with your definition of literary versus popular, though again, I am also not the sort of person who likes labels too much. I think it very often happens, you know, they're depending on the different hierarchies of reading, what one reader might think of as a breezy, fast-paced, you know, therefore popularish book might be a somewhat difficult book for another reader. So, you know, so there's a lot of subjectivity there. One thing I'd add to what you said about literary writing being about things that are unfamiliar, good literary writing, in my view, also has the effect of allowing the reader to recognize himself in what might seem to be very unfamiliar things. So, you know, so you find yourself in the process of reading such a book, empathizing with, understanding, perhaps relating to the sort of character who you would never earlier really have thought of as someone who you would identify with. That's one of the functions that good literary writing can help serve. But yeah, this is a complex topic, and beyond the point, I feel like these categorizations don't really work, because even the matter of what book is an easy, fast-paced read versus a dense, difficult read, even that is a massively subjective thing. It depends on how much reading a particular reader has done in the past, how familiar you are with a particular genre. All those things play a big part in that.
Okay, that's interesting, and I think this is I think you put it very, very beautifully. I think, you know, in terms of empathy, what I guess that was where we're going with is that a great novel creates empathy.
But you know, now see, I'm glad you said a great novel rather than a great literary novel or a great popular novel, because I feel that it's often happened with me. Even with all the reading experience that I have, even today, I'll sometimes pick up a really well-written, mass-market book, popular book, and I'll find a lot to empathize with in that as well. I won't only be thinking, "Oh, this is just a flippant thing that provides me with some entertainment value, and I don't have to think deeply about it." I've found myself stirred to deep thought by popular fiction. Definitely by popular cinema. That's one of the big bugbears I have when I practice film criticism, that so many people deal in these easy binaries about this film is serious and this film is only entertainment. And I don't think I don't really believe in those binaries beyond a point.
Yes, I mean, we grew up in Bengali society with this battle of Isman. Who's better, Manmohan Desai and Satyajit Ray? Of course, everybody said Satyajit Ray, but it was, I mean, and which kind of brings us to the main topic, which is villains. But Manmohan Desai was seen to be by Bengali, let's say, chauvinists, maybe a little too strong a word, but in terms of, like, you know, everything bad about the Hindi culture was he was the emblem of that, was Manmohan Desai and his movies. And so it was like, you know, sure, Manmohan Desai makes a lot of money, but, you know, Satyajit Ray might not be making any money. I mean, look at the place where he stays in Bishop Lefroy Road. But the fact is, he's kept his, you know, artistic integrity intact while this guy is making Amar Akbar Antony. So again, I obviously, as you know very well, I kind of, you know, at least I agree with you. I also appreciated Amar Akbar Antony, and there's a different part of my brain that appreciates it and considers it to be a great film. Yeah, and I would consider Charulata to be a great film in a very well different
put.
Way.
That's very well put, a different part of your brain. And I think, you know, let me just first say, you know, on a slightly facetious note, as a non-Bengali, this is the first time I'm hearing of this particular binary about Ray versus Manmohan Desai. When I got into cinema the first time, all I was hearing from my Bengali friends was, who is better, Ray or Ghatak? I mean, so you guys, you know, that to my mind, you were so highbrow anyway that you wouldn't even bring Manmohan Desai into a conversation like this. Something else, very quickly, what you said about different forms appealing to different parts of our brain, I think that's very relevant. It is relevant to anything that we're going to be talking about here, because there are many different cinematic expressions. There is, for instance, the expression of psychological realism, where everything is rooted in how people really behave in the real world, etc. But there is also the allegorical or the mythical mode, which perhaps is the mode that someone like Manmohan Desai would operate in, where it's not about that sort of kitchen sink realism. It's about using archetypes, symbols, metaphors to arrive at some deep truths about the human condition as well. And I think both forms can be done very well or done very badly or done mediocrely. So one more thing, Adna, before I shut up now, I don't know if you recall, but back in the early years of blogging, you and I both, around the same time, both of us wrote very impassioned blog posts about Revenge of the Sith when it came out 2005. And both of us were just going, because we just felt so deeply for the film, we were getting into analogies where we were talking about the Palpatine Anakin relationship in terms of Shakespeare and things like that. So we were doing it fairly unself-consciously. So it can be done. That sort of analysis of the popular can absolutely be done. I think it's a valid way of looking at anything.
I absolutely agree. To the main topic for today, which is what we had discussed before, was because I really admire the way that you think seriously about things. And this is a topic which I felt that you would have some ideas on, which is a villain. Like, since we both of us, we like to read books and we like to watch movies. I wanted to focus more on movies because my audience will possibly get the villains much easily, but we can talk about literary, villains too. So I wanted to talk about, creating or crafting a great villain. And what is your opinion, having read so many books and watched so many movies, from Mogambo to Darth Vader, whatever you have? I mean, what would you say makes a great villain, a memorable villain?
Oh God! Now you're really putting me on the spot again. These are very difficult questions, mainly because there are so many things that can go into it. And again, even if we stick just with films for now instead of talking about books, everything depends on the type of film it is to begin with. So to take a really boringly obvious example, now if you look at someone like Gabbar Singh or even someone like Mogambo. The nature of those films is such that it would be a bit silly to expect a certain sort of fleshed out nuance from the presentation of these characters, where the one cliche is that all of us have shades of gray and that in the real world most people, even people who do bad things, have backgrounds and their own private reasons and justifications for behaving in a certain way. Now, if you look at Hindi cinema as it currently is, where it's become perhaps a little over-obsessed with the psychologically realistic mode, where characters have to be really fleshed out and made completely believable, then, in a film like that, a character like Gabbar Singh or definitely Mogambo might not, work because these people are, within the films, they are just pure evil. They are representatives of pure evil. It's not like there's intended to be any nuance or any backstory or anything of that sort. And for those films, in my view at least, it works because the tone of the film is essentially allegorical or mythic. It's not meant to be, a realistic examination of a particular person. Does this make any sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. It absolutely does.
Trying to continue this thread. So, for instance, what happens is that when you ask the question, what makes a villain truly effective in this context, the answer to that question won't be that the villain is a completely believable person in terms of how we know real world human beings. The answer would be something as simple as the quality of the actor's performance, the quality of the writing by Salim Javed or whoever, the overall execution of the film, the way in which music is used in a sinister way around the character, as is done in Sholay with Gabbar Singh, mm-hmm. the way yes. in which the character is situated within the larger story around him, does Amjad Khan's performance or Amrish Puri's performance as Mogambo, do they fit the world of the film, of this particular film? Which is something very important, and my answer to that is yes, they absolutely do. These actors know what type of character they're trying to create. So those are the things that can make a villain really effective in a film like this. In another sort of film, in a film that we call a really gritty, realistic film where all characters are three-dimensional or even four-dimensional or whatever you want to call them, in such a film, maybe the effectiveness of the villain will lie in other areas where it could be a tragic villain, almost someone who has a backstory. There could be a narrative arc where a person who might have sort of just been a potentially good person has, through circumstances, come to a point where he or she starts doing bad things. And that dramatic impetus is what, that dramatic arc is what makes the villain effective. So the answers really vary, I feel, with the type of film one is talking about and what the purpose of the villain is within that film. What do you feel?
So for me, the success of a villain is almost directly proportional to the journey and the obstacle that the hero or the protagonist is facing.
Yeah.
So if it depends, in a way, the villain, the effectiveness of a villain is really a direct function of how good the story is. If in terms of what is the obstacle, again, I'm repeating myself, but what the obstacle is. So in case of Sholay, I think Sholay is again, I totally agree with what you said. Sholay is meant to be not taken literally. I mean, it's not it's not hyper real. In that respect,
yeah.
But what makes Gabbar Singh so memorable is you write much of it is of course the dialogues that Salim Javed wrote for him, but it's also it's a part of the story. I think for me, what makes Gabbar Singh so different from pretty much every villain that came before him, there might be some exceptions that I've missed, but this was the first villain that at least I remember. I can't remember anybody after this also. Might have been, who basically shoots a little boy, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's no reason.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was about to mention something along those lines, but carry on. Yeah.
That shock thing. We've been used, and it comes in the 70s. We've like for 40 years, people have seen villains. They've seen villains like Pran, and people were villains, but they might have some redeeming quality to them, or at least whatever. Really, villains you can't take seriously, even in the context of a Hindi movie like Prem Chopra, Sheeshe Se Patthar Thok. I mean, it's cartoonish villainy in many ways. Yeah. And along comes this person in a 1975 movie. It's going okay till then, and then there's a little boy who's playing, and he shoots him, and they show that swinging, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you immediately understand that it's this sense of loss. This is not just a little boy who gets. It's not just another person who vaults into a tela and the pots and the matkas break, and this is not that. There is consequence to what this person is doing, and this person is doing it while basically laughing. So this person is a psychopath. This is the first psychopath that you see who has zero empathy with anyone, like a seriously damaged in person. And there's no reason given why he's that seriously damaged. Yeah. I think that establishes him as somebody who's very memorable. I don't think they wrote a villain like this ever after this too.
Yeah. One of the things that I was thinking about when you asked me to discuss this topic is that it's absolutely true that one of the things that would make a screen, an on-screen villain truly villainous is the killing of a child. So this trope, for instance, Gabbar shooting the boy, and the film obviously not, you know, the film not explicitly showing the shooting, just showing the close-up of the gun and the close-up of the boy, and then cutting to the train whistle at the station. That is actually lifted from an earlier film, which was Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, where Henry Fonda, who plays Frank, the villain in that film, he does the same thing to a child. And yeah, that was a complete game changer, because, you know, I don't know if you remember the story about how, you know, back in 1936, when Alfred Hitchcock made this film called Sabotage, there's a scene in that film where a little boy is carrying a package while traveling by tram. He's been asked to deliver the package somewhere, and he doesn't know that the package contains a time bomb. And eventually, of course, the bomb bursts and the boy is killed. Hitchcock got so much flack from audiences and critics back then for daring to show the death of a child, because that was a complete taboo back then, and it was still largely a taboo in mainstream cinema in the 60s and the 70s, and certainly a big part of the visceral loathing that we might feel for someone like Gabbar, or for someone like the Frank character in Once Upon a Time in the West, comes from that scene. So yeah, that is an absolutely valid point. The nature of the specific action being done by so-and-so villain.
Right. A question that follows is, why do you think we don't have villains in Hindi movies anymore?
What sorts of villains?
Like, think of movies for the last 10 years, 2010 to 20, even think from 2000, let's say, 20 years of filmmaking, Hindi filmmaking, popular Hindi filmmaking. What villains, like what great villain characters come to your mind?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Actually, a few do come to my mind, but I also see where you're going with this. Part of the thing, of course, is, you know, what I alluded to earlier, that Hindi cinema, with the exception perhaps of the three or four really massive 200 crore films with Salman or Shah Rukh or whoever, which get released every now and then, with those exceptions, a lot of Hindi cinema, definitely what we used to call the indie cinema, is operating in a completely different mode now. They are not operating in the larger than life mode. They are deliberately aiming for a very different sort of narrowly defined realism. And once you're doing that, then of course you're always going to be very self-conscious about this idea that real world mein larger than life villains to hote hi nahi hai. Everybody is to some degree or the other a product of circumstances. So even people who do terrible things, you know, the film needs to just get deep into that character's background and that character's psyche, and perhaps have a certain degree of empathy for that character as well. So the question of having either a pure psychopath like Gabbar Singh, or as you put it, a cartoonish villain like the Prem Chopra sort of villain of the 70s, or the Ajit sort of villain, the question of those villains is really not going to come up a lot in contemporary Hindi cinema. But having said that, let me also mention a couple of depictions of villains which I found very interesting in recent years, because these are what we might call the contrapuntal villain. You know, the sort of figure who intuitively one would never think of as a villain, but who turns out to be one. So, for instance, if you look at the hitman Bob Biswas in Kahani. Now here is someone who's this very meek looking man who looks, at least to a lot of non-Bengalis, looks like the stereotype of the shy, diffident, a Bengali man wearing large glasses, and you know, and just pottering around, and then he turns out to be this really focused hitman who's also an insurance agent.
And Andrew takes a rickshaw to a kill.
So yeah, which is brilliant. And who eventually gets destroyed by Kolkata's traffic, which is the thing that that's how the character.
Okay. Bob Biswas. Okay, I give you that. Yes, definitely.
But also in Gangs of Wasseypur, there's the character in Varanasi who looks a bit like a master G, who's actually just wandering around, and he turns out to be a gun runner, dealing in weapons, and then B, somebody who just sort of quietly goes about his work, looks very meek and mild before blowing away one of the major characters in the film. So you have characters like that where you know it's a different mode. It's a different idiom from what Hindi cinema used to be, where you could just regularly identify that the minute Pran appeared on screen in the 1960s, for example, or Prem Chopra in the 1970s, you just knew that this is the antagonist. But there are slightly different things going on in recent films, I feel.
So for me, again, the reason why I wanted to talk about villains, and you wonder, for all the topics in the world, why villains? But for me, at least as a writer, somebody who writes fiction, I'm very fascinated by villains. In the last two novels that I wrote, one of which you've possibly read, Jay, which is Sultan of Delhi, and Mahabharat Murders. Both of them are basically, tales anchored to the villain. In Sultan of Delhi, of course, Arjun Bhatia is a villain in many ways. But again, he's not. He's a more classical, he's actually a good person, but, he does some bad things. But he's basically not he's basically a good person. In a place where everybody else is terrible, he's the least terrible of everybody. Mm-hmm. And then in Mahabharat Murders, I've tried to reinterpret, and without giving any spoilers, the original Mahabharat narrative, as in, here's the villain you didn't see in Mahabharat.
Yeah. Okay.
So I that's why I'm kind of, I love the idea of villains. One point that you raised is that why haven't we seen somebody, like, I understand that Hindi movies there's been a paradigm shift with multiplexes. They've moved from the more cartoonish, larger than life characterizations to, I would say, a more international aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even then, you have a movie like Ek Tha Villain, where the villain is not memorable. We don't even have somebody like Hannibal Lecter, right? We haven't been able to make in the last 20 years somebody even close to a Lecter.
Yeah.
We do try. I mean, the Ek Tha Villain is copied from the name is escaping me, this Korean movie. And we do that, but we somehow cannot come up with the exception of Bob Biswas, I would say. But even then, Bob Biswas doesn't have a huge role, but he does have an impact even in the amount of footage that he gets. That we don't create memorable villains anymore. Even in a hyper realistic milieu, you can create great villains. Which brings me to the next question. Who are your favorite villains?
In cinema.
There
are many. There are many. Well, again, the boring answer, Amjad Khan's Gabbar Singh is one. There are many others. I find, one character, you mentioned Lecter already. So taking off from there, I think Hannibal Lecter to me is a very interesting way of discussing certain things about how villains get represented on screen, partly because the character has had so many avatars on screen. You know, on the first, if you know, there's the 1985 film Manhunter, which had Brian Cox playing Lecter. This was Lecter's first depiction on screen, and it was a version of the book Red Dragon. But Lecter, though he had a couple of very striking scenes, he was not by any means one of the major characters in that film. So, you know, so Brian Cox was there, he was very menacing, but Lecter is this interesting sideshow in the film. Then comes Silence of the Lambs, in which, again, actually Anthony Hopkins' screen time in that film is very little. I think it was just something like only 20 minutes or something, but the character is indelible, and it is very much, you know, Lecter is one of the two central characters in the film, and then the sequels to that film. And then you have this TV series, Hannibal, which I have a lot of, I love that series. It isn't to everybody's taste, but I really like it. And there it's interesting because what they've done there is they have the backstory. They have Lecter as he was before he was apprehended, before he was unmasked. So he is, though he's a psychopath, he's also forced into the position of leading a regular life. And he's practicing psychiatry himself. He's forming friendships. He is, of course, cooking, these very terrifying things in his kitchen after committing his murders. But what happens there is, in a show that is spread over 40 episodes, 40 almost 1 hour episodes, it becomes almost inevitable that the character will have to become fleshed out. You can't sort of just portray a character as a pure monster with a few attractive qualities here and there. You see him in many different contexts. You see him preparing meals for his friends. You see him, appreciating an opera performance where he's so deeply moved that there's moist, you know, his eyes are watering. He's so moved by the singer's performance. This is Lecter, the aesthete. So what happens is that this is also a long-winded way of saying that the medium makes a difference. And I think during one of our chats earlier, you mentioned that one of the characters you had in mind was the lead character of Breaking Bad. Is that right?
Yes.
So there again, now I haven't seen Breaking Bad, unfortunately, but there again, I would imagine that a show that is spread over 4 or 5 seasons or whatever it is, you would get to see so many different dimensions of the same person there's no way you would be able to just think of him in one-dimensional terms as a bad guy. So if you want to say something about that?
Yes. So for me, I'm glad you brought up Walter White. So Walter White and Hannibal Lecter in many ways are kind of two great ways of doing villains in two totally different styles, narrative styles.
Yeah.
So with Hannibal Lecter, when Hannibal Lecter is first introduced, leaving aside Brian Cox's, you know, performance, which I haven't seen that movie, by the way. For me, Hannibal Lecter starts from Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. But from the first scene, we know he's a serial killer and he's a cannibal. Yeah. And from the first scene, you don't know what his backstory is, but he starts off as evil. He's introduced as very dark, evil person who's manipulating this rookie FBI agent. Yeah. Psychologically manipulating from behind bars. So he's presented as somebody who is almost black and white villain. He's black, totally.
I'll just interrupt you for 2 seconds to say that I actually disagree with an aspect of what you said just now. But carry on, we'll come back to that.
Sure. Yeah. So he's established as evil, I would say. And the manipulation is very, very evident in the way that he's manipulating this FBI agent. The violence there is psychological, more than anything else. Yeah. And, you know, there is also a place where that senator comes in. And, you know, he's, for those of you who haven't seen it, I don't want to spoil it for you. But essentially, he's a guy who's immensely psychologically violent, and then when he comes out, he's also physically violent too. But you know, he's a dangerous lot of goods. That's how we are introduced to him. And then over the years, when people get fascinated with this character, we build them I would say we retrofit a myth around him. You know, he's also a, you know, he's also an aesthete. You know, he loves to find music, and you know, cannibalism is just a lifestyle thing for him. Whatever, it comes kind of comes as a, you know, it comes from black. He kind of moves to, he's just a guy like you and me. Oh, and he also eats people. So that's for me is Hannibal Lecter. Walter White is fascinating because it goes the exact other way. So Walter White, for, and I know you haven't seen it, but I strongly recommend that you see Breaking Bad, because you'll love it, because it's also a very classic Hindi movie in every way. Huh. So Walter White, again, he starts off, you know, the basic thing is that he's a school teacher, he's a high school school teacher who was diagnosed with cancer. So in order to raise money for his kids, so this entire, he starts brewing, you know, brewing meth. Not meth. What was he? I think meth. He started. So he's a chemistry teacher. So he makes very, very pure drugs. So it starts off as almost like an AK Hangal thing, right? This is like the first season, the first few seasons, he is like AK Hangal. Like, he's a very nice guy. He's a very popular guy. And he's got cancer. This is like, there's almost like a Nirupa Roy kind of situation where the eyesight goes and everything. And so you can see this very old classic Diwar thing going on, where he is becoming bad because he also got screwed by his classmate who took his ideas and became rich. And then over the seasons, you see that as he becomes more successful as a drug dealer, he starts enjoying. He realizes that all of this bechara thing is, in a way, he's convinced himself all through his life, he's actually loved doing this. And you see him moving towards this extremely dark place where he's absolutely immoral. Zero empathy for some. He starts off with a person with empathy. You feel empathy for him. And then at the end, you realize that itself is, his real villainy isn't the people he's killing or the people he's manipulating, but his real villainy is he's been able to convince himself and his family that he's actually a decent human being, and he is not. At the end, actually, there is one of the great, these are great episodes where at the end he says, you know what, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact lines are much better, but he basically says that I did all of this and I enjoyed it. You know, this made me feel alive, you know, yeah. All this villainy, and I loved it. Yeah. So I think that it follows an entirely different path where he goes from white to black while Lecter goes the other way. And yes, so I finished. So Jay, what were you going to say?
Oh, many things really. Well, you know, Breaking Bad, yeah, I do need to see it. The problem is one, it's quite terrifying in a different way to start watching something that you know is going to take up 40, 50, 60 hours of your time and it's not even something that one is going to be doing, you know, for professional purposes, writing about or something most likely. But this isn't so much disagreement, I realized. I think it may be a matter of different perspectives. But when you said that about Lecter in Silence of the Lambs psychologically manipulating Clarice Starling, the Jodie Foster character, etc., you know, there is of course a way in which he's doing that, because you know he's there, he's this stunningly intelligent, sharp, almost omniscient character, and she needs his help, and he's sort of toying with her in some ways, even though he's the one behind bars and she's the one outside. But there's another way of looking at it, and I don't know if you'll agree with this, but it's just a different perspective. You know, if we ask the question, what makes a villain truly effective, a truly sort of, you know, the villainously effective, and one answer to that question is his or her potential danger to a likable protagonist who we identify with and care about in the film. So here, you know, one can even sort of play devil's advocate and wonder if Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, is he even a villain at all? Because the Clarice Starling character, who's one of the most likable and sympathetic protagonists we've had in films in decades, she is a point of entry into the film, the Jodie Foster character. And Lecter, apart from a couple of minutes when they first meet, where he's sort of just, he's toying with her and refusing to be cooperative, etc. But then he develops concern for her because of what another inmate does to her. So from that point on, he is helping her, even if he's also toying with her and playing psychiatrist and taking her into uncomfortable places, into her own mental landscape. He is essentially helping her. Whereas there's the other character who's in charge of the jail, Chilton, who is, you know, within the context of this narrative, he is probably more of a villain, as in a completely uncharismatic, loathsome figure from Clarice's point of view than Lecter himself is. So again, this is just a way of saying that everything, you know, but I think our perspectives on these things change all the time, depending on the nature of the story, depending on a character's arc within the story. So that's really what I wanted to say about Silence of the Lambs. But yeah, I obviously agree broadly with what you're saying.
I had a couple of questions for both of you, if I may.
Sure.
One, earlier you guys had spoken about, you know, villains in the literary world versus movies. So are there any great literary villains who have not found their way to the movies yet? Can you think of any?
I'm sure there are.
Because the moment that something clicks, you know, at least in the Hollywood world, in the Western world, it gets made into a movie. Anyway, while you're thinking about that...
The answer that I would give straight up that comes to my mind is the character of Uriah Heep in David Copperfield.
But there have been film versions of David.
Numerous versions.
But there's nothing iconic, right? It's not like, for instance, Thomas Harris's novels becoming movies. I don't think anybody would call any Uriah Heep as a cinematic villain, right?
Yeah.
It would all be a...
True.
But I think there's a great villain character in terms of books, if you just want to look at just books.
And staying with books, I mean, any of the villains in the comic book world who strike you?
One of my absolute favorite graphic novels or comics, whatever you want to call it, is Alan Moore's From Hell. It's one of my absolute favorite books and works of art, whatever you want to call it. It's not enough to just call it a comic or a graphic novel. And this is basically a fictionalized depiction of Victorian society in the 1880s when the Jack the Ripper murders took place. And what Moore does very interestingly is he picks up one of the more outlandish conspiracy theories about who Jack the Ripper was, and no spoiler alert needed because it's right there in the book right from the start. It's the royal conspiracy theory, which is essentially that Queen Victoria herself orders the killing of these women because of this deep threat to a royal Syrian, because they harbor a royal secret, and her elderly physician Sir William Gull, who was a real life figure, of course, who was actually a royal surgeon in the 1800s. He actually goes about this task of killing these women. And he also has his own private motives for doing it, which have nothing to do with the reason why he's been commissioned the task. Now, there has been a film version of From Hell. But it's a film that it's an interesting enough film in its own terms. But as someone who read the book first and who knows what a capacious work that book is, how it depicts Victorian society and the many evils that existed in that society, in that world, and how the idea of Jack the Ripper is almost a production of the terrible things that were going on in the world back then. From that point of view, I feel like that's definitely one of the characters that I mean I would love to see a web series as opposed to just a single film that dealt with that character, William Gull, as portrayed in Alan Moore's From Hell.
Anyone for you, Arnab, from the comic world?
I was going to my next question was going to be about Todd Phillips's Joker. So of course it is this is a cliche answer to say Joker, but it's Joker in, I don't know if you've read this graphic novel called Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth, written by Grant Morrison.
No, I know about it, but no.
So it's the visuals are very, very scary. I mean, it's very difficult to have scary visuals. And this graphic novel actually does. And Joker is, so the basic premise of the story is that Joker has taken control over Arkham Asylum and he's calling Batman to come to Earth. So there's a kind of a flashback as to, you know, how Arkham Asylum was started, you know, who was the person behind it, which is also a very pretty scary thing. And, you know, obviously at the end, it all links together. But Joker basically calls Batman to Arkham Asylum, almost as the subtext of it is that Batman also belongs there.
Yeah.
So that's the subtext and kind of Batman. It's just brilliantly drawn. I mean, for the want of a better word, I'm using the word drawn. But just the way the panels move, and if you just go and just, you can just look at a panel for like minutes and find like small details which will again come back later on.
Yeah.
So I think it's, and Joker, he's not there in many of the panels. Again, it's more about, I've forgotten the name of the character, but, you know, the original Arkham who starts that kind of asylum, he basically, a guy comes and murders his family. So, you know, he's the real villain, but Joker, he kind of pervades that novel, and it's just the way he's drawn. He's drawn in a very different way in that novel, in that graphic novel, than he's drawn anywhere else.
Yeah.
I love that, and it kind of gives me a segue to the next question. Is Jay, have you seen the latest Joker, right?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
So, what is your opinion on this Joker versus that Joker?
Versus the Heath Ledger Joker.
Versus the Heath Ledger Joker. Of course, there's only that Joker. Jack Nicholson also. If you want to bring him, Jack Nicholson in too, I think it's.
Well, there's also the glorious 1960s Batman TV show.
Adam West.
Are you consciously, not naming the one, the Suicide Squad Joker?
Oh, that I haven't seen that. But at risk of sounding like the complete inverse snob, who's putting down a certain sort of hyper serious depiction. We can skip that. What I was going to say was that I am very ambivalent about Christopher Nolan's Batman films. I don't have the great boundless love for them that many people seem to have. Heath Ledger was, of course, very good as the Joker. One thing I'd like to sort of just point out is that the nature of the new film, Joker, is such that you can easily make the argument that the character that Joaquin Phoenix plays in Joker is not actually Batman's nemesis. You know, you could completely postulate by the end of that film, you could postulate a situation where because of what this Joker does, you know, the anarchy that he unleashes on the streets, someone else comes along and appropriates the idea of the Joker and goes on to become the Joker that we all know from comic book lore. So I'm not even sure that they are the same character to begin with. But again, to answer your question more directly, I think again, you know, here you have a classic situation where the Heath Ledger Joker is the villain who is already fully formed. You know, we are sort of experiencing him after he has sort of, you know, whatever has happened to make him a certain way has happened, and that's what we are experiencing. So you have these terrifying scenes where it seems like he's explaining himself to someone by recounting a really sad backstory, And then, you know, just when you feel, oh, so this is the terrible thing that happened to this guy to make him what he is, the next time he tells a story to somebody else, it's a completely different story. So suddenly that idea of pure nihilism just sort of comes in with that character. With the Joker of last year's film, you have a somewhat more conventional narrative arc which depicts a particular character being, you know, beaten up so much, literally and otherwise, by a cruel, unjust world, that things just happen, things just escalate. You know, if you look at even that scene in the train where he kills those people for the first time, it's something that almost sort of happens organically. It's not something, you know, it's like the gun is there and then the next minute it's in his hand and then he's shooting and then there's that marvelous little second where he's so disoriented, you see him for a split second, you see him directing the gun towards his own head and then sort of moving it around. It's almost like he doesn't know what to do. And it sort of just happens. So I think one is a case of a villain that's fully formed, and the other is a case of a work in progress. That again might be a simplistic way of putting it, but that's what I felt.
So for me, in Nolan's Batman, it was a more conventional villain. As we started out this discussion, a villain basically exists as an impediment to the hero's journey. Where the hero was very clearly defined, it was a Batman movie. There was no Joker. It was not a Joker movie. Yes, true that the performance of Heath Ledger dominated the movie and people kind of forgot that there was a Batman there too. But it ultimately, the purpose of Joker was, again, a very standard purpose. But in the new Todd Phillips one, there is no Batman. There is no moral grounding at all. There is no hero. Even Batman's dad is shown to be a jerk. So over here, the Joker is the hero. There is no villain in that movie. So the bait and switch is you go to watch the origin story of a villain, but actually you see a hero's journey with no villain. So that's the joke. And that's what I feel at the end when Joker says, "You won't get it." I mean, my interpretation is that's what you won't get.
I was actually reminded of something, Arnab, and again, I don't remember if we had this conversation back in the old blogging days. Were you also a fan of Shyamalan's Unbreakable?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I am a fan, but I don't think I ever discussed it. But I did like the ending of Unbreakable a lot.
So it just came to my mind. In fact, it's something I hadn't even really thought about when we were about to start having this conversation. But it just came to my mind. There, the Samuel L. Jackson character, who is revealed at the end to have basically constructed himself in the mold of the classic comic book supervillain. And that is a reaction to this to his own very unfortunate circumstances, where he's been born with this terrible condition, and he becomes obsessed through his reading of comic books and his reading of comic book mythologies. He becomes obsessed with the idea that there has to be someone who is exactly the opposite of me in the world, someone who is almost indestructible. Whereas I have been born with this condition where my bones are so brittle and, you know, I just small fall and this happens. So if I can find someone who's almost indestructible, then in a way that reaffirms for me that I know what my place in the world is, and that place is as a villain, as a sort of super villain. So in a sense, it's interesting because it's almost a case of this character constructing the Bruce Willis character, and or at least persuading the Bruce Willis character that you are a superhero. It's your job in the world to go out and to do all these good things, but my real purpose for bringing that to your attention is that it helps me define who I am in turn, and it helps you understand who I am. So I think that's one of the more interesting takes on the synergistic relationship between a hero and a villain, which I think you were also talking about just now.
Yes. So that, for me, that's, again, Jay is somebody who, you know, writes books after reading books, or in my case, watching a lot of movies. I would again, I say, I've in terms of the books I've read and the movies, far more movies, is that, and I think it reflects in my writing too. But I am fascinated by narrative structures, why villains exist, why some villains work more than some others, and portrayals. That's why I felt that Todd Phillips' Joker is so unique, and I was so, and made this very unpopular contention on social media that this was a far better performance than Heath Ledger. Because Heath Ledger's, at least, I mean, some of his stuff is pure dialogue bazi, Hindi movie style, right? He has great dialogues. He just gives those, delivers those, you know, audience will throw chavanni at those dialogues. Joker, the new Joker doesn't have, you know, he doesn't have a lot of great dialogues. It's just, and there's no antagonist. There's nobody up against him. It's basically a one-act play. And that thing that you started off with, is this the Joker? I also think it's not the Joker from a very simple timeline perspective. He's much older than the Joker. He's almost his dad. Like, he's a little younger than his dad, right? So he's much older than Batman in this. Like, he's a little kid. So you're right. It might not be that Joker, but at the end, there is, you know, it's almost like a, yeah, this is old stand. This is the old, you know, Rashomon trope, or you know, whatever I say is the truth. If I'm the unreliable narrator, the narrator gets to decide what the truth is.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So since the entire thing is through him, so we know that, you know, all of it could have been a lie. None of this could have happened.
I also wondered what you. I know you're the one who's supposed to be asking the questions here and initiating the, you know, the different threads of the conversation. But one thing I wondered was about your thoughts on the idea of the charismatic villain, of a villain who becomes appealing to the audience on some level, because he's sort of, he's firing off little zingers and witticisms once in a while, or just sort of saying very, very sharp, smart things. And how that also affects different types of viewers, because I know many viewers, especially the for lack of a better word, the moralistic viewer, tends to be very put off by such characters, because, you know, they feel like, you know, if you have somebody who's doing bad things and the film is also trying to make that character seem charming or likable in some ways, then that's in very bad taste. But there are other types of viewers who can appreciate that quality in a character. Do you have any favorite charming villains that you can think of?
Charming villains, with respect to, see, there is, I don't know if there'll be, I can't think of a charming villain in that respect. But with Joker, I'll again come back to Joker. Joker is the new Todd Phillips Joker. And that's why it's such a polarizing movie, you know, in today's, you know, woke in the woke echo chamber. That's why so many people are so pissed off at it, because they feel that the charm of Joker is essentially that it legitimizes quote unquote white rage. So there is a movie which basically says, hey, white people have a lot to get pissed off about, and look at this Joker, and it's so sympathetically portrayed that you'll come out ending feeling bad for white people. There's a lot of articles written in Slate about why, you know, Joker getting Oscar nominations is such a terrible thing, because this is a glorification of male white rage. So I think that in a way, the answer to your question is Todd Phillips Joker. I mean, he is magnetic. You feel bad for him throughout. I mean, the purpose of the movie is to make you feel bad for him throughout.
Yeah.
And then he does all these terrible things. And I think that's an example. That's an example which comes straight. And I know that this led to a lot of controversy on woke social media. I think in Hindi movies also, when we were growing up, there was, you know, our parents used to articulate this thing that, you know, villains glorify, you know, this kind of behavior. Yeah. That that somehow we will be influenced by it. For me, I was, and I'd written this long before, that I think a more dangerous thing was this kind of behavior that Aamir Khan was shown to be indulging in Dil, where it was the hero who was actually doing this kind of behavior, which was considered to be macho and, you know, the way to do it, you know, the real men do this. That for me was the more dangerous message than Shakti Kapoor or somebody. They're bad guys. Everybody knows it, and they make it very clear that this person is a bad guy and will get bashed up at the end. Yeah. So that the message of that was clear enough, but I was a little bit more concerned with that in this point, but I don't buy this whole woke thing that, you know, you are somehow supposed to be influenced by popular culture in a way, as you're an adult, but somehow popular culture has influenced you and changed your opinion. I just don't think that works for me. But to the short answer, no, I can't think of any charming villains. Who would you think of?
No, charming is a very general word, and it can encompass many different sorts of behavior. Again, I'm thinking of, I could even be thinking of, you haven't seen Hannibal, the TV series, but Hannibal, as portrayed by the Danish actor Mads Mikkelsen in the TV series, is a really charming sort of fellow. I mean, he's a good-looking man. He's always impeccably dressed. He's a gourmand. He's cooking for his friends. There are these little witticisms that come out of his mouth, where he sort of just tosses bon mots off with a straight face. So all that is very charismatic, and I found it interesting because I was actually, while watching the show, I was also following a lot of the message board discussions on a website that was reviewing the show episode by episode. And one thing I found fascinating was that this business of how a charismatic villain can end up implicating a viewer. Because, you know, we get attracted to a particular character type, and then the carpet is pulled out from under our feet when we have to sort of deal with the full repercussions of this person. You know, there's the implications of what this person is doing. So in season 2 of Hannibal, there was one episode, in episode 4, 5 or something, where one of the regulars, one of the series regulars, was in fact murdered by Hannibal Lecter. It didn't happen. It wasn't explicitly depicted, but the dead body was shown, and it was all very morbid and upsetting. And at that point, I was reading these message boards of Hannibal, you know, where Hannibal fans were discussing things with each other, and suddenly a whole bunch of people who were earlier just talking about how hot Mads Mikkelsen was and how Lecter's, you know, how Lecter's such an appealing character, suddenly said, okay, you know, we have to take a step back here. We don't find him so appealing anymore. He's actually a loathsome, repulsive character because he's killed this other character who we liked on the show. And there was this whole agonizing and all this introspecting after that. So I feel like the idea of the charismatic villain or the charming villain, if it's done well, can also serve a really lethal purpose for a viewer, because suddenly you've been implicated in enjoying this person, in enjoying watching this person because of certain superficial aspects of his behavior, and then suddenly you have to also deal with how evil he is.
That's a good point. I don't know, have you seen Dexter?
I haven't, but again, I know about it, and I know the basic the premise.
So even with Dexter, we had something similar. So when it starts off, Dexter is a serial killer who kills other serial killers. And his motivation is shown to be that it's basically like a disease for him. And his dad knows that he has to kill in order to basically stay sane. So it starts off with a weird justification, which I think is poorly developed. But he is a hero because he's killing serial killers, right? He's killing the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
Now, as the show goes on, he starts off again. This is not as great as Walter White, but it's still a very, very enjoyable, and there's a subtext going on. But then later on, as the show goes on, in order to cover up murders, his own murders, he has to then start killing normal people.
It becomes a slippery slope. It becomes a moral slippery slope after that.
Yes, it becomes the moral slippery slope at some point. But at that point of time, you're kind of still rooting for him to kill these people because you don't want him to get caught.
Yeah.
Because the entire sympathy is for this guy.
Yeah, that's very clever. And I don't know, you of course know the classic scene from Psycho that's been discussed so much, or from Hitchcock's Psycho, where Norman Bates has the dead body in the car and he's trying to sink the car into the swamp. And there's that little moment where the car stops sinking for a few seconds. And at that point, as Hitchcock pointed out in interviews, every member of the audience is willing the car to sink. Mm-hmm. Because you want the story to continue. You want to, you know, and Norman has almost become this sympathetic young man who's covering up his mother's murder, the murder committed by his mother. So you have that sort of thing that gets done a lot, I think, in these sorts of villain depictions.
It does. And I think that one of the, maybe let's conclude today's discussion with perhaps that bit of convergence, that I think the great villain is somebody who you feel for. Even if it takes you to uncomfortable places where you find that you're in a way supporting his acts. And you might criticize that in the woke world, that is really the fault of the story. But I think we can both agree that whether it's a fault or not is another thing, but that's definitely the success of the story.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, as a reader or as a viewer, you have to be sufficiently invested in what is going on screen. And that, of course, that means, you know, if for a character to work for you, you know, to be convincing, there has to be a certain degree of engagement, investment. I'm not sure that there always has to be empathy, because I'm not sure any of us empathize with Gabbar Singh, for instance. What we would like, you know, is that, you know, we feel invested in the character because of some of the points I mentioned.
Yes, Gabbar is never presented like that, but the Walter Whites, the Hannibal Lecters, and Dexter, they're all presented, they're the main characters in the story.
Yeah.
So there is no Jay, there is no Viru, there is no moral compass in any of these. These guys are the moral compass. So you kind of end up being repulsed by what they do, but also think, I don't want the guys to get caught.
Absolutely, that part. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jay. Thanks a lot for it. It was very, very fascinating. I just loved this, having this conversation, and we should do this more often. I feel there's a need for deconstruction of narratives. I just love doing it as an author myself and as a film watcher. As to, okay, watch the movie now that it's done. What worked, what didn't?
No. Thanks a lot again for calling me. And yeah, this is the sort of topic, and I'm sure there are many other topics we can think of that one can just deconstruct away till the end of time. There's so much more to say about each of these subjects. So maybe we'll do that again at some point.
We'll definitely.
But thanks a lot for having me here.
Thanks a lot, Jay, for coming.
So that's our podcast for today. And boy, I had a lot of fun listening to it, and I'm sure you did too. Jay's books are available on Amazon. Jay, you want a quick word about your books?
I've mostly done books about cinema. I did a book 10 years ago exactly about the making of Jaane Bhi Do Yaaron, which as many of you would know is a film that has a cult status today. It's a 1983 comedy that never seems to go out of style or become irrelevant. It's a dark comedy. And I've also done a book about the films of Hrishikesh Mukherjee, the director, which came out a few years ago. And I've edited an anthology called The Popcorn Essayists, which is made up, thankfully, of the writings of people other than myself.
Yeah, all of these are available on Amazon. As is Dr. Alok Ray's autobiography. Arnab, a quick word about that.
Yes, so my father's autobiography has come out, and our next show we'll have Dr. Ray with us. So we will be discussing that book as well as the Union Budget for the next lovely podcast.
Lovely.
Oh, great.
So you've all of you have got some buying list on your Amazon. So anyway, until next time, take care. Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.